This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Imagine that we both have guns and I shoot at you. What would you do? Now imagine that you aim for the bullet I fired, pull the trigger, and blast it out of the air. Got the image? Good. Then you're on your way to understanding missile defense. Shooting a bullet with a bullet is just how U.S. military officials describe the systems that are designed to destroy an intercontinental ballistic missile in flight. This week, the Pentagon made some progress with a high-speed, high-stakes test to intercept a Mach warhead over the Pacific. That successful test came as North Korea launched yet another missile. In this hour, we'll answer your questions about missile defense and how it fits into America's military strategy toward North Korea and other hostile nations. Joining us from Lincoln, Delaware, is retired Major General Francis Mann. He's the former director of tests at the Department of Defense's Missile Defense Agency. He also served as director for strategy, policy, and plans at NORAD U.S. Southern Command. That's the North American Aerospace Defense Command. Fran, welcome to 1A.
Thank you.
Also with us from Harvard is David Wright, a physicist and co-director of the Global Security Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. David, welcome.
Nice to be here.
Joining us in studio is Stephen Pfeiffer, the director of the Arms Control and Nonproliferation Initiative at the Brookings Institution. He's the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. Welcome, Stephen.
Happy to be here.
And Thomas Carrico is director of the Missile Defense Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and he joins us from the center. Tom, glad to have you with us.
Great to be with you.
Francis Mann, let me start with you. We got to go with the basics. Missile defense gets very complicated very quickly, so walk us through this like we're a fourth grader. We're talking about shooting ballistic missiles out of the sky. What is a ballistic missile?
Well, a ballistic missile, very basically, is a rocket with a warhead on the end of it that is launched in a ballistic trajectory, meaning it generally does not maneuver. I point it and I shoot it. As in the example you gave, very well, I might add, the bullet on a bullet, what the Missile Defense Agency recently demonstrated is pretty extraordinary. Now separate the two armed individuals by more than 5,000 miles and try and shoot his bullet with your bullet.
These are different from what we heard of cruise missiles, right? You said that these are not really guided, so you just kind of shoot them up in the air and they land on their own on the target?
Generally, it's basic trigonometry. You launch it towards where you want it to go. It flies a long arc to get to the impact point, and it does not maneuver in flight normally. Now, that's not to say there's not atmospheric effect on it. It goes outside of the atmosphere normally. The higher range, the intercontinental ballistic missiles, the intermediate range and the medium range, they leave the atmosphere, fly very, very fast. We're talking thousands of meters per second, and they do not maneuver as they are in their end game, so to speak.
David Wright, what about the missile defense systems? If we're talking about hitting a bullet with a bullet, what are some of the basic physics behind making that happen?
Well, the first thing you want to do if there's a missile launch is to figure out that the missile has been launched and try and figure out where it's going. The U.S. has satellite sensors that can see the launch. That sort of sets the, you know, rings the bell that starts the whole process. The United States then has sensors of various kinds around the globe. Those radars will detect and then track the warhead as it's arcing through space, as the general talked about. And since it's above the atmosphere, as he said, it's on a smooth path. And so the idea is for these radars to track the path as well as possible, predict where it's going to be in the future. And the other thing you need to do is that when the missile releases the warhead early in flight, it might also release decoys, debris from the release process. And so one of the things that the system has to do is try to figure out which one is the bullet and which one are things that you don't want to waste an interceptor on. And then based on where you think it's going to be in the future, you fire an interceptor. That's a rocket that instead of having a warhead on the front has what's called a kill vehicle. You shoot it in the general direction. The kill vehicle has a little telescope on it. It tries to see the warhead, and then it has little thrusters, and so it tries to maneuver itself to physically ram into the warhead. So the destruction is not by an explosion, but is by the kill vehicle ramming into the warhead.
So I want to make sure I'm picturing this correctly. When I think of a nuclear warhead on a missile, you have a missile, a long ballistic object with a nuclear weapon on the tip. And then this interceptor, this other device, is basically the same way. It's a long ballistic object with this kill vehicle on the tip. And that's what actually hits the target missile. Is that it?
Yeah, that's right. And when people think about a missile, what they often don't realize is most of what you see on the launch pad is just a big tube to carry the fuel that you need to get the thing up to a very high speed. And the payload, in this case the warhead or the kill vehicle, is actually a small object on the front end.
Stephen Pfeiffer, can we talk about how we got to this point? I think the way that many people began to think about missile defense is with President Ronald Reagan in 1983 proposing a missile defense system that a lot of people came to call the Star Wars missile defense system. Here is a piece of what President Reagan said.
Let me share with you a vision of the future which offers hope. It is that we embark on a program to counter the awesome Soviet missile threat with measures that are defensive. Let us turn to the very strengths in technology that spawned our great industrial base and that have given us the quality of life we enjoy today. What if free people could live secure in the knowledge that their security did not rest upon the threat of instant U.S. retaliation to deter a Soviet attack, that we could intercept and destroy strategic ballistic missiles before they reached our own soil or that of our allies?
That's President Reagan speaking back in 1983. Now, fast forward to last year. Here is Donald Trump as a candidate on the campaign trail in Cincinnati.
We will rebuild our depleted military and pursue a state-of-the-art missile defense. We will do it based on those three very famous words. Peace through strength.
That's Donald Trump on the campaign trail last year in Cincinnati. Stephen Pfeiffer, at what point did this idea of a missile defense system, of being able to basically shoot a bullet with a bullet, become politically viable? Was there a moment when the U.S. began to turn more towards these systems as possibly a workable option?
Well, actually, the United States and the Soviet Union looked at missile defense going back, back to the early 1960s. In 1972, though, they concluded the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, in which both sides severely limited their missile defense capabilities. President Reagan, I think, was very uncomfortable when he discovered that in the event of a Soviet missile attack, his only response was to respond with nuclear weapons. So he announced in 1983 this idea of the Strategic Defense Initiative, the ability basically to stop a major ballistic missile attack against the United States. What we found, though, over the last 30-plus years, and despite spending hundreds of billions of dollars, is that missile defense is very, very difficult to do. Now, what we have done and we have now achieved is the capability to intercept a bullet with a bullet. Tuesday's test was certainly a success. It was an important achievement. But also, I think we have to recognize it was under test conditions where the defender knew where the target was coming from, knew the time of the launch, and there were no decoys or other countermeasures. So it was an important step, but there's still going to be a lot to do before you get a reliable military defense that could defend the American homeland 24/7. And that would be against a limited nuclear attack, for example, that North Korea might be able to mount in the future. If you're talking about dealing with Russia or even China, you're talking about a greatly, greatly expanded missile defense, which would be hugely expensive and would provoke reactions on the other side.
We're talking about all things missile defense with Stephen Pfeiffer of the Brookings Institution, Thomas Carrico of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, David Wright of the Union of Concerned Scientists, retired Major General Francis Mann, formerly of the Pentagon's Missile Defense Agency and NORAD U.S. Northern Command. And with you, we welcome your questions and thoughts on missile defense. We'll get to them in a moment. There's a lot of basic information we're trying to get out. just so we're all on the same page. But please do keep your questions and thoughts coming, and we'll get to them on the other side of the break. 1A@WAMU.org. Comment on our Facebook page or tweet us. We're at 1A. Tom Carrico, I wonder if before we have to take a short pause, who do you think is leading the way right now in missile defense? Is the United States the farthest ahead, or are other nations making more technological progress in terms of being able to hit a bullet with a bullet?
You know, that's actually a pretty good question for the following reason, that although many people think of this as merely sort of an American idiosyncrasy, over the last decade especially, that's really begun to change. Between Ronald Reagan and Donald Trump, there's been a lot of development, a lot of work. The GMD system we have today for homeland missile defense began as the National Missile Defense System, or NMD, under Clinton, and then was deployed by Bush and has been sustained by President Obama. But over the course of that, a number of U.S. allies, NATO has taken on ballistic missile defense as a core alliance mission in 2010. And we see a lot of allies in Japan, South Korea, and the Middle East who are putting real resources behind this, real investment. They're doing so because they look out and they see various missile threats, whether it be from Iran or North Korea or others. Mm-hmm. And they're not quite satisfied with the idea of merely relying upon, as it was said, the threat of retaliation. So you see, you know, this isn't science fiction anymore. You see hit-to-kill technology being used in real-world scenarios.
Hey, I hate to cut you short. Hold that thought. We're up against a break. I'll let you finish your thought on the other side as we continue our conversation about missile defense. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing missile defense strategy and what missile defense is with David Wright, a physicist and co-director of the Global Security Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, Thomas Carrico, the director of the Missile Defense Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Stephen Pfeiffer, the former ambassador to Ukraine and current director of the Arms Control and Nonproliferation Initiative at the Brookings Institution, and retired Major General Francis Mann, former director of test at the Department of Defense's Missile Defense Agency. We'd love to hear from you, too. Share your questions and thoughts about missile defense, what it is, how it works, whether it works, and how it fits into the U.S.'s arsenal of dealing with major global threats. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Tom, I'm sorry I had to cut you off before the break. Let me give you a chance to finish your thought, and then we'll keep going.
Right. So I think we were talking about kind of how, you know, missile defense technology has moved to really become much more of a not really an American phenomenon only, but also that of many allies. NATO has taken on the mission in a big way, and so has our allies in the Asia Pacific and the Middle East begin to really put some serious investment behind this. And I think it's because they see a lot of missile threats that they don't want to be completely vulnerable against. And I think that trend is going to continue. It's really sort of an established part of national security for the United States and for others.
Fran, I want to play a clip from a Fox News report about the missile defense test system, the missile defense test. This is Lieutenant Colonel Timothy Brower. He's the commanding officer at Fort Greely in Alaska. Fort Greely houses 32 of America's 36 ground-based interceptors. And this is him speaking to Fox News reporter Jonathan Hunt. Listen.
You've got a nuclear weapon fired heading for L.A. How many of these do you fire to take it down?
So the tactics, techniques, and procedures, those are classified, but I'll say we fire more than one. If we're talking about a nuclear warhead headed to L.A., we want to make sure that we get it.
All right, that's Lieutenant Colonel Timothy Brower, the commanding officer at Fort Greely, Alaska. Fran, so how long do you think it will be until we are able to get it if there is a warhead fired at Los Angeles? I imagine we're not there at all right now, are we?
Well, I would say we've got the capability to defend ourselves. Now, taking the Lieutenant Colonel's comment, do I shoot one interceptor against one target? Do I shoot multiple interceptors against that one target inbound is the question. All the tactics, techniques, and procedures right now for all the weapon systems we field, fire multiple interceptors against an inbound target. And you do that to get your assurance you're going to kill that target. One of the biggest challenges you have is discriminating amongst that cluster of objects that are coming towards you, which object is really the warhead you want to kill. And that's the challenge, because there are decoys and there is debris in that cluster. And the interceptor has to determine, where's the warhead amongst that cluster? So you fire first interceptor, you may fire two interceptors, three interceptors, until you're pretty confident you have destroyed what might possibly be the warhead in that cluster.
David Wright, I have to admit, all of this feels very Star Trek to me. I mean, the idea that we can just shoot a bullet with a bullet, a nuclear warhead, a nuclear missile out of the air with an interceptor at all, still feels very much like the domain of science fiction. Is this even a realistic goal? Granted, eventually the technology will catch up, but for today's geopolitical threats, is missile defense really realistic?
Well, I have to agree that it does sound amazing, and the technology is really fairly impressive. But I think it's important to realize that there are really two steps to getting a missile defense system to work. One is the process of trying to what we call hit to kill. In other words, if you can identify the warhead, can you send an interceptor, a kill vehicle up to destroy it? That's basically what the tests have been doing so far. We see that we can do that with some reliability, and that's a really fairly incredible technical task. But, you know, as we've talked about a little bit, there's a second piece to making a working defense, which is the enemy, while they're developing a ballistic missile, if they're intending to use it, is going to look around, see what kind of system the U.S. is building. It knows what kind of sensors the U.S. has. And as it's developing that missile, it's going to be thinking about what it can do to make life very, very difficult for the defense. And we've talked about decoys. There are ways to think about putting decoys on that, again, would be within the technical sophistication of a country that's assumed to be able to build a long-range missile and a nuclear warhead. And so there are other sorts of things. And that's the real trick, is even if you can hit a bullet with a bullet reliably, if you can't identify which object to shoot at, then you can't be confident that you can actually stop the attack.
Steve Pfeiffer?
Yeah, no, I think the general raised this question, and David just addressed it, the discrimination. How do you tell what is a real warhead as opposed to decoys, which in some cases in space could be just metallic balloons? And if you can't make the...
I'm sorry. Balloons?
Balloons.
Remember, like Mylar birthday balloons?
Remember, you're out in space. There's no atmosphere. So that balloon is going to travel as fast as the warhead. And if it has metallic coating, it may look on the radar like a warhead.
So we're spending hundreds of millions of dollars on a weapon system that a birthday balloon from Safeway could evade?
This is one of the challenges that I think the Missile Defense Agency still has to solve, is how do you discriminate so that when you shoot, you're shooting just at the warhead and you're ignoring the decoys. But I'll give you an example of the problem. Say the North Koreans have a missile with a warhead, this is some point in the future, and maybe seven decoys. So they launch, we see eight objects. If we take the general's example, and to be sure, you launch three interceptors at each one of those objects, that exhausts half of the interceptors we have on that one missile. So solving that discrimination problem is going to be really vital to making missile defense work in a way that would be cost-effective for us.
So really, detection is just as important as defense.
Not just detection, but then when you detect it, saying, is that a warhead, is that real, or is that designed to...
Right, not detection, but discrimination.
Discrimination, exactly. Yeah.
Speaking of which, we should get into some questions from our listeners. One of them has an issue with the analogy that we've been using, this bullet hitting a bullet idea. Mike tweeted, it's not an accurate analogy. Bullets don't have onboard terminal guidance systems. But I think, David, the analogy is accurate. We're talking about a device that is not guided, aren't we?
Well, the enemy warhead would typically not be guided. So that's that you're tracking through space. I think what the person's saying is the bullet you're shooting at it to try and intercept, which in our case would be the kill vehicle, does have a sensor on it and thrusters so it can maneuver itself to try and hit. Which makes it a little more believable that you could do it, right?
G.S. Fish emailed us, how real is this last quote-unquote successful test? Was every possible variable manipulated to ensure the highest chance for success? Fran, do we know exactly how many variables were involved in this test and whether it was real-world circumstances or kind of stacked to be easy to hit?
You know, that's a good question. When you do these tests, and I take a little bit of an exception to people saying they're scripted, that lieutenant colonel had operators on the consoles. They knew they were in a test window, but they're not hearing any of the, I'll call it the test control network. So they don't know if they are, as things appear on their screens, if this is the target in flight or this is another test dry run until they execute all their processes and procedures. And they're told, you killed it, or that was a good dry run, or here was an anomaly. So, you know, there's realism in the test. The operational distances are real. This target, this ICBM target, carried complex decoys. First time they've done that. I can't define what complex decoy means versus simple decoy, because I'm not privy to that classified information. But the tests really do stress the realism, the operational distances, the challenges in the architecture and the limitations of our senses. Prior to actually executing a flight test, they spend many ground tests and simulations are run to try and determine what should happen, what might happen, and then to think their way through the variables that will mitigate the challenges before we actually get to the flight test.
Tom, could I ask you, how far along are we in this whole testing process? I mean, I think about, you know, when you're teaching a little kid to play basketball, you put him on the court alone and just have him shoot hoops. And then when they start to make baskets, maybe you bring out a few other players. Are we at the place where we're just doing layups, or are we actually in real-world game scenarios? Where are we?
Well, I would say that in terms of the long-range missile defense, we're not sitting there dribbling. As the general Mahan noted, you know, the warfighters are there day in and day out, and they exercise this every day. Just in case those satellites detect something. And so this is something that has been operationally deployed since 2004 in Fort Greely, Alaska. I think everybody would like to see more testing. As the general noted, you know, these things have become increasingly complex, increasingly challenging over time. Next year, they're going to do a kind of a salvo test where they do fire more than one interceptor at a threat. And that, of course, as we just discussed, is more closely approximates what would actually happen in the event of a launch. So I would say that we've come a long way since the sort of the 2002 timeframe when the United States said, okay, we're going to go ahead with this.
Nathan tweeted us, if we shoot an intercontinental ballistic missile out of the sky, won't nuclear material just rain down over the target? David, what would happen with the missile once it's destroyed?
Well, the speed of intercept is so high that you would create very high temperatures that would burn up a lot of the material. And the hope is that if your system's working right, you would intercept this over the ocean so that the debris would come down not over your city. But I think even given all that, if you had the choice between having a nuclear warhead land on your city and explode, or have it destroyed and have some debris fall down, I think it's pretty clear which one you choose.
Is it easier to shoot one of these ICBMs out of the sky higher up or further down, or does it make a difference?
Well, so when the missile is arcing through space, it loses speed as it goes up to its peak. The same way anything would lose speed as it goes higher. So it's somewhat easier to intercept when it's high in the atmosphere, or high above the atmosphere. On the other hand, if you're trying to do discrimination, the assumption is going to be that you'll need to watch this system for a long time to try to decide which is the warhead and which are decoys or debris, and that you'll probably end up intercepting it fairly late in flight. I mean, if you can, you'd like to take various shots at it throughout the trajectory, but you may not have that possibility.
We've gotten a number of questions from our listeners about the practical implications of putting these missile defense systems wherever they are. They got to be somewhere, and they're not all going to be in the United States. Stephen Pfeiffer, these tests came as the U.S. has been ramping up some of its missile defense efforts. We've been hearing a lot about a system called THAAD. The South Koreans are very, at least South Korea's new president has expressed real concern over a THAAD deployment in his area. There have been some protests. What is THAAD? This Terminal High Altitude Area Defense Missile System. Is this basically the bullet with a bullet thing we're talking about, or is it something else?
It's the same thing, except it's designed to intercept shorter-range ballistic missiles of the kind that, for example, North Korea might launch at South Korea. And there, if you look at THAAD, or if you look at a counterpart program called the SM-3 missile interceptor, which the United States has on board some of its warships and is now deployed in Romania, that also has the same principle. But again, they're dealing with shorter-range ballistic missiles, which means the targets are moving more slowly. And so THAAD and SM-3 actually have significantly higher success rates in tests. I think the SM-3 is 35 successes in 42 intercept tests, as opposed to the system tested on Tuesday, which is about 50% in its tests. That reflects the fact that it's an easier problem when you're going after a shorter range or a medium range ballistic missile as opposed to an intercontinental range missile.
So what about the controversy over having these systems? Tom, what do you make of South Korea's president and some of the protests as well in objection to having these THAAD systems there?
You know, what I guess I would point out is that this is a system that, as Steve mentioned, is in some ways rather well suited to the kinds of medium range threats that North Korea has. The threat in the peninsula. This is, furthermore, a capability that several of the last commanders of U.S. Forces Korea have said is exactly part of the solution that should be there. Last year, early in 2016, there was a nuclear test, there were some missile tests, and on a formal basis, South Korea and the United States said, okay, we're gonna look at THAAD in a more formal way. And by summer of last year, they said, you know, we really are going to go through with this, and as soon as feasible. And so what you saw this spring, I think it was in March when they rolled it off of the trucks, you saw a lot of relief. I think it was none too soon. I think that there's been a lot of pressure, in particular from China, about, I think in some ways they would prefer that South Korea and U.S. forces in Korea remain more vulnerable rather than less. I don't think anybody suggests that one THAAD battery is anywhere near a perfect shield for the peninsula. You'd need several of them, and you'd need all kinds of other things for Seoul and things like that. But I think that it does make a lot of sense, notwithstanding the kind of the geopolitical objections from China. And this is something, after all, that both the Obama administration and the Trump administration kind of agreed on. Mm. And the reason, I think, is that that kind of even a limited defense there adds to the overall credibility of our deterrent posture in relation to North Korea. Regardless of what it is, they're going to have that much more confidence that the retaliatory forces of the United States and our allies will be brought to bear.
Stephen?
Yeah, no, I think that issue in China illustrates one of the issues that we need to think through as we think about missile defense. The Chinese concern about American THAAD missiles in South Korea is, rightly or wrongly, that the radar with the THAAD missile in South Korea could actually look into China and perhaps detect Chinese missile launches, and then maybe queue up the missile defense system if the United States intended to use those interceptors in Alaska and California to stop a Chinese attack. And that's, I think, more broadly one of the issues that we need to think about, is while developing a missile defense that protects us against North Korea, we don't want to build a missile defense that leads the Chinese to say, hey, we need to build more intercontinental ballistic missiles to strike the United States, because we have to worry about our ability to get through. And the problem we have there is, at least with current technology, it's probably a lot cheaper and easier for the Chinese to add offensive ballistic nuclear warheads than it is for us to add missile defense.
We're up against a break in just a moment, but on the other side, I would like to talk a little bit more about where missile defense goes going forward, including a comment we got on our website. Barlenin wrote on our site, the1a.org, if North Korea launches a missile against an ally and we intercept it successfully, what's our next move? Whatever we do would have to be in agreement with Japan and South Korea and with acquiescence by China. If there's any delay beyond a few hours, it would also need some kind of political okay. My point is that if you add up technical variables and diplomatic, legal, and political constraints, a successful intercept would lead to a new set of problems that we should be addressing diplomatically and politically now. Good point, Barlin. And what are we doing to deal with the aftermath of missile defense? We'll discuss it with David Wright of the Union of Concerned Scientists, Stephen Pfeiffer of the Brookings Institution, Thomas Carrico of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and retired Major General Francis Mann. Keep the questions coming, and we'll answer this question in a moment. Stay close. Back now to our conversation about missile defense, what it is, what it does, how it works, whether it works, and how we would use it. To the whether we would use it and how we'd use it point, Barlenin wrote on our website, if North Korea launches a missile against an ally and we intercept it successfully, what's our next move? Whatever we do would have to be in agreement with Japan and South Korea and with acquiescence by China. If there's any delay beyond a few hours, it would also need some kind of political okay. My point is that if you add up technical variables and diplomatic, legal, and political constraints, a successful intercept would lead to a new set of problems that we should be addressing diplomatically and politically now. Tom and Stephen, I'd love to hear both of your responses to Barlenin's question. Tom, let me start with you.
So that's a great question, and I would immediately flip it around and say, what happens if you, and contrast it with what happens if you don't have the capability to intercept it. To specifically answer it, what happens after you intercept, say, a North Korean missile is you have options, and you, in a way, have the flexibility to respond to that in a variety of different ways, as opposed to either having to merely retaliate in the face of an attack. Or, frankly, leading yourself to preempt so as to prevent that attack from taking place in the first place. This is not a hypothetical. I'll give a couple of examples here. It's sometimes said that missile defense leads to more, or might lead to more risky actions by, say, the United States. But I think actually the opposite has been borne out. First, in 2006, when North Korea had a rocket on a launch pad, Ash Carter, future Secretary of Defense Ash Carter and former Secretary of Defense Bill Perry said, you know, we got to take that out on the launch pad so they don't have an opportunity to do that. The Bush administration said, no, you know, we have some ground-based interceptors to do this. Let's not do that. Let's wait and see. But more recently, in 2016, just last year, a U.S. ship was attacked. This is a cruise missile problem, but it was attacked by some anti-ship cruise missiles from Yemen.
Mm-hmm.
But those were defeated with some of their onboard ship defenses. And as a result, instead of that ship burning, as an Emirati ship the week before had, the United States had the flexibility to respond in a manner of its choosing. And President Obama fired Tomahawks and took out those batteries. But the point is it creates options.
Right. Stephen Pfeiffer, what do you think?
Well, Tom and I don't always agree on some of these questions, but here I agree with him. The ability to knock down that North Korean missile does create options. You have the ability to take things more slowly if you wish. And again, if that missile got through, your options would be more limited. But I guess I would make a broader point here, too, in thinking about how you deter, how you persuade the North Koreans not to launch that missile. Your ability to intercept that missile is going to have an impact. I mean, if young Mr. Kim thinks my missile might get intercepted, he's going to think twice about whether he wants to launch it. But there's also another aspect of deterrence, and that is if Mr. Kim is thinking about launching a nuclear-armed intercontinental ballistic missile at the United States, the prospect that we might intercept him will deter him. But I think a larger factor in his thinking is going to be if that warhead gets through and detonates in the United States, the utter destruction that would rain down on Mr. Kim's regime in retaliation. My guess is that's probably going to be a much larger factor than the missile defense possibility at this point.
I wonder then whether or not, David, this shows that we are getting closer to actually making a go of this. I mean, this week's test was apparently a big win, but with the run through this week, there have been only 5 of the last 10 tests, as I understand it, that were declared fully or partly successful. And this has been going on for about 13 years since this system came online. Are we making progress? Is this a turning point, or do we still have a long way to go?
Well, I think this, you know, we are making progress in the technology. As I said before, that's only half the battle. You then have to be able to get it to work against an adversary who's trying to fool you. There's a question about developmental tests and what are called operational tests. I have been told by somebody in the Pentagon that the Pentagon testing officer actually downgraded this test from an operational test to a developmental test, basically because of things about the way that it operated. And I don't know what those are. And my argument is that, you know, the system is such a hard thing to do that that having developmental tests and trying to develop the technology and trying to understand what we have and where we can go from there is completely reasonable thing to do. And I don't have a problem with that at all. The thing that worries me, though, is that there's a tendency to see a test like this and jump from that to the conclusion that we have a system that's working. And, you know, there are unfortunately quite a few comments from people in the Pentagon, the administration, over the years that I think really overstate the capability and says, you know, that the United States could shoot down a long-range missile from North Korea today and that we're protected.
Right.
So that's my concern, is that I think we're telling the public and we're telling the, you know, political officials that we have a capability that we're still in the process of working on.
Fran, I'd also like to get your take on this, especially in light of the cost of this. I mean, this test, the one that happened this week, reportedly cost almost $250 million. And the entire missile defense system is apparently somewhere in the ballpark of $40 billion. With the success rate so far, with the gigantic amount of money being spent right now, is all of this worth it? Is the money being well spent?
I would have to ask you the question of what's the security of America worth? What's the value of a major metropolitan area worth? If you did not have a capability or a capability in process, in work, what would your adversary's willingness be to take that first step? I mean, many, many times you look back through our history, an adversary has made an attack because he thought we would not respond, or he thought we did not have a capability to defend ourselves. And I think that's the dynamic that we wrestle with. Yeah, these tests are expensive. I mean, in all honesty, we string out test assets, you know, data collectors, sensors to gather data on the target and the interceptor in flight, clear across the Pacific. I mean, there were people on ships with sensors tracking the target in flight, tracking the interceptor in flight to capture that engineering data to go back and be able to analyze this and determine, did we kill it or didn't we kill it? And did all the elements inside the interceptor and the target function as they were designed to function?
Well, I think I understand you on that. But I mean, this is a tremendous amount of money, and there are more ways than just interceptions to prevent an attack like this. I mean, there's a lot more being done with cybersecurity and digital means of preventing attacks, maybe intercepting the warhead in flight. We know we can shoot the warhead on the launching pad. We could just go shoot it before it takes off. There are diplomatic channels, there are political channels, there are economic channels. At a certain point, don't we run the risk of trying to swat a fly with a sledgehammer? Is this really the best way to defend the country?
Well, I would tell you, you know, when you speak missile defense or air and missile defense, there's more than one pillar. We've been talking about the defensive posture. There's an offensive posture, attack ops. There is the political aspect, and there's a consequence management, because if you fail to defend and he gets the first opportunity to strike, how do you deal with that strike? The consequences on the ground, and then the secondary consequences of what's your response. So I think you want totality as you prepare to deal with a threat such as this. And having a defensive posture, you know, I kind of liken that to how many sports do we play out there without a goalie?
CSN Ironclad wrote on our website, the1A.org, North Korea has moved into a position where we now are openly talking about having to shoot down their missiles to protect the U.S., South Korea, or Japan. That's obviously unacceptable now, and it'll get worse as North Korea builds more rockets. No one wants a war in the area, so what is the best path to avoid one? Stephen?
Well, I think missile defense makes a contribution, but I guess I would go back to my earlier point, is at the end of the day, North Korea or another potential adversary would understand that a nuclear attack against the United States would result in a massive U.S. nuclear response. And so if Mr. Kim is thinking about launching his ICBM against Seattle, he has to think, even if he gets past that missile defense, what's the United States' response going to be? And it would be the utter destruction of his regime.
Well, but wait, but pause on that right there. If that's the case, then why are we doing missile defense? I mean, Kim Jong-un knows that the United States has enough nukes to blow it off the face of the earth 1,000 times over. And yet, he still apparently is rattling these sabers. Is that enough?
This is where I see missile defense. It's a bit of a hedge against a mistaken, miscalculated decision by him that could give you the ability to defend against, you know, a couple of ICBMs. But again, once you talk about going beyond that, I worry that the cost dynamic begins to work against us. We're adding, in the process of adding, 14 new interceptors to the field up in Alaska, and they cost about $70 to $75 million apiece. My guess is that adversaries probably could build additional warheads for a significantly less price than that. So we need to be careful that we don't get into a race where our emphasis on defense provokes the other side to do offense at a cheaper rate and then ends up with an expansion of the nuclear risk against the United States.
David, we talked earlier about these decoys, I know I'm being a little flippant by describing them as Mylar party balloons, but I get what you're getting at, some kind of debris to throw off the guidance systems. Is that kind of technology also being looked at in the event that, for example, a more targeted weapon is shot at the U.S.? Is this just a matter of figuring out how to blow up a weapon in flight, a missile in flight, or is there science in the works about distracting them, deterring them, sending them off course?
Well, people have been looking at a lot of different ideas. People have thought about lasers, other things of that kind. And the problem is, again, as you look at that sort of menu of options, there are problems on all of those sorts of things. I mean, if you want to have lasers, you presumably need to put them in space so that they don't have to go through the atmosphere. Once you put them in space in low orbits, then they move with respect to the Earth, so they're never in the right place. So that's the reason that after thinking about this for a long time, people have tried to focus on the system that's currently being built. One other system that people have talked about, which for North Korea might be a better option, is to talk about having what are called boost phase interceptors that are sitting on ships in the Sea of Japan. And the idea there is that instead of trying to shoot at the warhead once it's been released and is surrounded by decoys, that you would have a very fast interceptor that would try to hit the missile body itself while it was burning. And that's hard to do because you have to be close to the launch site. But the advantage here is that North Korea is a very small country, and so it's sort of tailor-made for boost phase. So I think that's another option that people are going to be looking at more and more.
Sue asks a very good question. Sue emailed us, please follow the money. Who gets these defense contracts? What are the profits to the companies? Stephen, who is building these systems?
I think it's Raytheon is building part of the projects, but there's a fairly wide set of subcontractors because it's a very expensive program.
Tom, do you know who else it might be getting some of these contracts? What's your read on who's making money off of all this?
Actually, this is, in a way, it's so kind of integrated not only into the U.S. national security strategy, but all the major primes are in some way integrated into the four families of missile interceptors, Patriot, THAAD, Aegis, and the ground-based mid-course defense system. So this is not a single company. It's a little bit of everyone.
And when you say the major primes, you're talking about like a group of companies that tends to get defense contracts? Who are these companies?
So that would include, for instance, as he said, Raytheon, Boeing, Lockheed, and Northrop Grumman. I mean, everybody has a little piece of the larger task, and that's it's not any one particular entity.
Peter is a little skeptical about the nature of the Pentagon's announcement. Peter wrote on our Facebook page, do you think the Pentagon would have told us if this test had failed? We have no way to confirm. Fran, what do you think?
Yeah, I think they would have. I think integrity is valued and in many respects. They couch what they say. The words are in there. Appears to be a success, although they've come back and reaffirmed it was a solid intercept this time. But it goes back to the level of analysis that'll go on. They will continue to analyze all the data they gathered. They will look for anomalies. They will do research that anomaly to determine, what caused it and how do we mitigate it in the future and could it have caused a serious problem. But I believe in the integrity and what Admiral Searing said.
You know,
I used to have to draft those post-test announcements.
You know, friend, to that question earlier about who is making money off this and who's profiting, since you dealt with budgets in your role at MDA, I know we've only got a few minutes left, but can you talk about how you thought through the way the money was spent and whether it was spent well based on what you were getting?
I think the challenge is unbelievably difficult from an engineering aspect and a science aspect. Tom was right. I mean, all the major defense contractors or vendors are involved. I mean, Boeing's the lead system integrator. Raytheon does the kill vehicle. Lockheed Martin's doing sensors. And then you get down into the subcomponent level. I mean, there are a vast number of small defense industry participants in the contracting event. I think the biggest challenge the Missile Defense Agency has today is it's balancing research and development versus procurement.
Right.
And their budget, and Tom can articulate this better than I, their budget has been depressed and on a negative slope probably for the past 6 or 7 years.
We're very short on time, but David Wright, I wonder at what point people on the West Coast should be worried about this at all. A lot of us have people we care about back in California and on the Pacific Coast. Is this something that we should be concerned about today, or is this still a few years off? Briefly.
It's still a few years off. I mean, I've been watching the North Korean missile program for many years, and what they have showed us recently, I think, is sort of a credible way forward to a long-range missile, but it's going to be a few years yet.
General Mann, what do you think? A few years off yet?
Yeah, I think a few years off, but it's interesting. You think back what the intelligence community was telling us they would achieve by 2015, 2017. Mm-hmm. We're definitely seeing progress. And you know, those dates are always guesses. It's a best guess in a range.
Right.
But they're getting closer and closer to having an ICBM capability, and they're clearly closer and closer to having a nuclear capability.
That is retired Major General Francis Mann, the former director of tests at the Department of Defense's Missile Defense Agency. He also served as the director for strategy, policy, and plans at NORAD U.S. Northern Command. Fran, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you very much.
Physicist David Wright, the co-director of the Global Security Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Thank you, David.
Nice to be here.
Thomas Carrico, director of the Missile Defense Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thank you, Thomas.
This was great fun. Thank you.
And Stephen Pfeiffer, director of the Arms Control and Nonproliferation Initiative at the Brookings Institution. Thanks, Stephen.
Thanks for having me.
1A comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you for listening. This is 1A.